From azimuth to zenith, welcome to Madison Science Radio for December 5th, 1996. My name is Brenda Hefty, and I'll be your host for this week's show on the auditory system. Today we have with us Professor Fred Whiteman in the Department of Psychology, and he's interested in how we perceive sound and how we decide the source of a sound in space. In addition to our interview with Professor Whiteman, tonight's show includes the Science Roundup, some auditory experiments, a calendar of science events, and, of course, the Geek of the Week quiz. Let's start with this week's quiz question.
If you were listening closely to that opening, you may have noticed that it came from a show long ago. From December 5th, 1996, PNM's first year on the air. That was 20 years ago, a time with a different president, a growing economy, decent prosperity, and even optimism for the future. That was then, and this is now. A special 20th anniversary episode of the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, November 10th, 2016. I'm your host, Dennis Schaefer. Tonight, we will reminisce with clips from some of our old shows and also publicize the show more than we normally do. In the opening, you also may have noticed a reference to the Geek of the Week quiz question. Back in the day, the quiz was a regular feature of every show. Tonight, we bring it back. One of our current PNMers, Jake Walters, is fond of doing shows about the brain, mind, and consciousness. Several of his shows had Kurt Gray as his guest. He's the co-author of the book, The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters, about how the essence of morality comes from mind perception. And last February, PNM aired a clip from Radiolab about kiddie morality. Kids seem to have, or learn, a moral compass on their own, as early as 3 years of age. There are several factors concerning morality, but one stands out. If one person acts mean toward another person, teases, bullies, or even confronts him physically, that person should realize he did something wrong. What one thing that all or most people have should make him realize that was wrong? This question is not as hard as it seems, and one president-elect probably doesn't have it. Now, back on December 7th, 2006, PNM did a 10-year anniversary show. I was able to track down two of the original volunteers and creators of the Perpetual Notion Machine, Chris Wedding Kroll and Kelly Loyette. Here's a clip from that show that also includes a short clip from PNM's very first show that aired on October 3rd, 1996. And on the air, we have Chris Wedding Kroll. Are you there, Chris?
I'm here, thank you.
And is Kelly and Andrew there also?
Yes, I'm here. Happy anniversary.
Thanks a lot. Chris, I thought I'd start with you. I think you were kind of like maybe the driving force behind the show. How did it start?
That's a really good question. There was somebody on the morning show, Jan Leventhal, had two scientists who came in once in a while and did a short science segment on her morning show, and the three of them had talked for a long time about expanding it into its own science show, and somehow I got connected up with them, and by the time we started planning for the evening show, the three of them were out of the picture, and I was talking to all sorts of people that I knew to get this new idea of this science. It was just originally called like science radio or something very bland and boring. And I think it was Brian Pruka who, after a few sessions, finally came up with the name Perpetual Notion Machine. So
I was wondering how that name started. Was anything specific about why it came up with that
name? It was one of those brainstorming sessions where a bunch of us were sitting around, probably in the studio there, trying to figure out something more interesting than science radio. And Perpetual Notion Machine seemed like a nice blend of puns and science and just random silliness that was appropriate.
Yeah, I was wondering about the format at the beginning. I mean, back in the old days, there was a lot going on in a half hour. Did you feel a little overwhelmed that you had to fill 30 minutes, or how did that format come about?
Well, I think so we had half an hour, so a lot of the thing, it was so funny to hear you mention the Geek of the Week quiz. I mean, that was certainly something we did to try to, like, okay, we're going to fill up time. Well, let's ask a quiz question. We get people to call in, and we had, we always had an interview, and we tried different things to fill in some time. We tried one time, like, going out and doing, you know, on-the-street reporting, and what do you think about life on Mars, and, you know, and found out that actually a lot of people weren't really interested in it, but.
And it's funny that you happened to mention that.
Oh, yes?
Yeah. I have a clip of that first show, and you might be, you know, I don't know if you remember anything like this or not, but go ahead and roll that, Anthony.
Thanks, Chris. This is John Fornell. I'm here this evening talking with Dr. William Barker from the Geology and Geophysics Department of UW-Madison. Dr. Barker is quite well-versed in geomicrobiology, and we're going to discuss this evening a recent finding that has come out in the literature, in the scientific literature, as well as in the popular literature about recent evidence that there might have been life on Mars. Can you tell us exactly what this evidence that has been found actually is, and maybe what you think about this evidence?
Well, I assume everybody listening knows a lot about it already, but we can go over it a little bit. A few years ago, some NASA scientists were down in Antarctica, and they were looking for meteorites, and the reason they do that is because they go down on the continental ice sheets where there's just ice, and if they find a rock laying out thousands of miles from any place where a rock could come from the Earth, they assume it fell out of the sky. And so they collected these meteorites in a very sterile way so as not to damage them, you know, and brought them back. And a few years later, they got around to analyzing them, and they found, much to their great surprise, that the rock was from Mars. And then they started looking for evidence of life, and they found these, first of all, they found polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which is just some organic compounds within the meteorite. And they have pretty good evidence that there actually are higher concentrations of these things within the rock than on the surface. And since it's laying on ice sheet for thousands of years, they also think that it's not contaminated, you know.
What makes them think that the meteorite came from Mars?
Well, you know, as y'all said before, in 76 we put some probes, the Viking probes, on the surface of Mars, and they did isotopic analyses of Mars. And it turns out that Mars has a pretty diagnostic isotopic signature, and these rocks match, whereas most, there are only like a dozen meteorites that match isotopically with Mars rocks. And also, most meteorites are not igneous rocks. They're you know, iron nickel meteorites or these stony meteorites, and these things are igneous rocks.
So even before people got to the question about life, they were just looking at these rocks and they believed that they had come from Mars because of the chemistry of the rocks and the what kind of minerals they found in them.
That's right. And then when they broke them open and they started finding all these very, very tiny, well, we ought to back up and say that for a long time there was no way to analyze these rocks optically, but in the last few years they've become possible to look at them with very powerful high resolution scanning electron microscopes. And so they started looking with these high powered SEMs and seeing all these little tiny things that look a lot like bacteria.
So we're coming up with our on the street reporting.
How would you feel if they say we found for sure that there's life on Mars?
Well, I think it depends on if it's like, you know, little chunks of bacteria or if it's, you know, like little green Martians. I mean, it makes a difference.
What's your name, brother?
Frank.
Frank. And what do you do other than play in a band?
I'm an accountant, actually.
What have you heard about the whole life on Mars thing? What do you think about it?
That's pretty intriguing to think about, you know? I mean, there's parts of the universe that we don't even know exist that could be, there could be like an exact replica of what we're doing somewhere. You know?
There could be a band called Fat Function there.
Playing right now.
Yeah, that was just a piece of what we did on our first show. Kelly, are you there?
Hi, Dennis.
Hi. When did you start on the show?
I think I started on maybe this. I listened to the first show. I wasn't involved in the first show. And then sometime after the first show, there was a somewhat of a membership drive, and I went and went to the meeting and started maybe the next show or the show after. I think the next show I just observed, and then started answering the phones the show after that, and then started contributing from then on.
Why did you start volunteering?
You know, I was looking for a good opportunity to volunteer. I loved wart. I think that one of the main reasons I started volunteering was, this may sound kind of funny, but Carl Sagan. I was reading a book by Carl Sagan, and in the book he was very much emphasizing the fact that one of the duties of as a scientist is to educate the general public, and I felt that it's definitely a problem that people just aren't as literate in science as they probably should be in terms of a lot of public policy is set about science, and I think that a show like the Perpetual Notion Machine goes a very long way in terms of making science more accessible to the layperson, and so I thought it was a great idea.
Yes, Kelly, that's very true, and Perpetual Notion Machine is still trying to do that outreach to bring science research and science in general to the general public. Besides Kelly and Chris, I'd like to give a shout-out to a few of our past volunteers, Andrew Prock, Chris Churchill, Brian Prukuk, Holly Simon, Karen Cassetto, Susan Nossel, Zeke Unterberg, Kate Rayford, Vanessa Pope, Linda Wasson, and Mark Young, who passed away in November of 2012 from complications of schizophrenia. And I joined PNM in the fall of 97, my first semester in grad school in journalism at UW-Madison. But I wasn't on the air until the spring of 1998 when I got my feet wet on the five-minute news segment known as the Science Roundup. But when I first started producing and interviewing guests, I focused on what I knew and was interested, or that interested me the most, environmental science. And we also have a Geek of the Week quiz question. Several of our past shows have dealt with the mind and morality. What makes a human being, or other animals as well, know the difference between right and wrong? When one person does something to hurt another person, what inside that person tells him that hurting people is wrong? This is a particularly positive trait that most people have and should regularly recognize and listen to. One of my favorite show topics that we've done over the years concerns climate change. I'd like to now play a clip from a show that aired on December 21st, 2000. PNM reporter Susan Nossel interviewed Rich Bogovich from the Wisconsin Environmental Decade.
By reviewing for us what is global warming, what is climate change, how does global warming work, and then turn to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and talk a little bit about their findings on this topic.
Well, global warming at a certain level is a natural phenomenon that makes life possible on Earth. Without a certain amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it would be a lot colder on this planet, and life as we know it wouldn't be sustainable. The problem is that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is at record highs and looks like it's just going to continue to climb for quite a long while. The carbon dioxide that was released in the 50s, 60s, up until the present day will be with us for quite a while. So what we have already emitted will be causing us problems with the climate for quite a long time in the 21st century.
Could you tell us, please, also about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and what their recent findings are in setting the stage for what the problems are that the international negotiations are aiming to address?
Sure. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is an organization consisting of thousands of scientists, over 2,000 scientists from around the globe who are experts on climate. About every 5 years, they issue an assessment report. And the third assessment report is due in 2001. However, a copy of it was released, or leaked, some might say, in late October. The theory is that that one reason for leaking it was to influence the presidential elections, but probably a more important reason for having a draft report reviewed in late October was the negotiation, the sessions in The Hague, Netherlands, that took place just before Thanksgiving, and in fact concluded just after Thanksgiving.
And what are some of the major findings of this report?
The major finding in the new draft, and even if the draft is rewritten slightly prior to final approval in 2001, that the basic core science will remain pretty much unaltered. The main finding is that they're projecting warming of a level of up to 11 degrees Fahrenheit over the next century. The previous report about 5 years ago put the projected warming anywhere between 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit and about 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit. Now they're revising that upwards quite a bit, going up to 2.7 as the minimum warming and 11 degrees Fahrenheit as the maximum warming that they're projecting during the 21st century. And that can be a huge difference. The difference between our present climate conditions and the conditions during the peak of the last ice age were about 5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit. So if we were to move 5 to 9 degrees in the towards cooling, we'd be in the middle of another ice age. You can imagine then what type of tropical conditions we'll be having further and further north if we're talking about 8 to 11 degrees warming Fahrenheit by the end of the 21st century.
Now turning to the local scene, or actually national scene from the international, what do you predict will be the direction of climate change negotiations and that climate change policy with the new Bush presidency?
Well, it's kind of a little early to say exactly. My understanding is that Governor Christy Whitman from New Jersey will be his nominee to head up the Environmental Protection Agency. And there were certainly worse choices that he could have made. Obviously, there could have been better choices, but the New York Times, for example, editorialized urging him not to appoint somebody with an incredibly strong connection to the fossil fuel industry, and as far as I know, Governor Whitman does not have that kind of strong connection. In fact, New Jersey, the state that she's governor of, is the first state to have pledged to meet the Kyoto Protocol's commitments of a 7% reduction in fossil fuel emissions by 2008 to 2012, in that range, so within about a decade's time.
And turning now to the local level, could you tell us what initiatives are in place in Wisconsin and what's coming up?
Well, in Wisconsin, there may be some policy developments with regard to global warming, and perhaps we may find some legislators who would be willing to make the same kind of commitment that New Jersey has made. I think what's most interesting from my perspective is an effort by interfaith leaders, religious leaders from across the state to be active on climate change. About a year ago, a little over a year ago, there was formed the Wisconsin Interfaith Climate Change Campaign. And it's been fairly active. It's had a statewide conference. It was in Green Lake this past summer. And now they're following up on that two-day statewide conference with regional conferences in about seven cities around Wisconsin.
And that show aired in December of 2000. There was an election that year. It's ironic that the election of George W. Bush in the year 2000 made most of us as nervous as hell about the future. And since that time, there has been virtually no progress on addressing the threats of climate change, and now we have reelected a climate change denier back into the U.S. Senate from Wisconsin. Yippee! I'd also like to recognize some more of our past PNM volunteers, Arazu Sarvastani, Hayden Marks, Gino Segre, Bennett Devereaux, Mark Formanek, who's in Seattle, Claire Radomski, Jim Carrier, who just left last year for Vermont, Bernie Sanders territory, Caitlin Stack-Whitney, and Matthew Smutka, who's on a temporary assignment in Europe for EPIC. I apologize if I missed anyone. The last clip I want to play aired on December 2nd, 1999 show. Holly Simon interviewed UW-Madison microbiologist John Lindquist about bacterial diversity.
So let's talk about bacterial diversity. Bacteriologists have for decades debated what constitutes a bacterial species. This is in part because, unlike most macroorganisms, the majority of bacteria cannot be easily distinguished based on their physical appearance or their ability to interbreed or exchange genetic information. So traits that can be used to distinguish different bacteria include some limited morphology. However, the real diversity of microorganisms can be found in their metabolic properties and capabilities, and it truly represents the richest diversity on Earth. Can you give us some examples of this?
Yes, well, certainly a lot of species of bacteria that might look similar, if not identical, through the microscope may be from diverse habitats and differ in many ways. Using all sorts of organic and inorganic chemicals as sources of energy, and some using light as energy, not only the cyanobacteria, which are green, like your traditional photosynthesizers, plants, and algae, but also some other photosynthetic bacteria that tend to be red or purple. Some satisfying their nitrogen requirement by taking nitrogen gas directly out of the atmosphere, some living in boiling hot springs, others at even below freezing temperature, and some dependent on other organisms for their habitat and nutrients, some causing disease, others beneficial in the way many in the intestine provide vitamins. And we have taken advantage of many of these organisms in their diverse physiologies to help us manufacture various fermented food products and help in waste disposal, produce antibiotics. And without bacteria, we would not be around ourselves in many ways. Production of oxygen gas on Earth, in fact, about 3 billion years ago was accomplished by organisms already able to use sunlight as the source of energy, but then turning to water for their hydrogen source needed in photosynthesis, and this released oxygen into the atmosphere, and that's a process that probably took a couple billion years to get to the concentration we have now. And these organisms, the cyanobacteria, which many people still call the blue-green algae, are still around.
So you have studied bacteria for quite some time and have been interested in bacterial diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically the bacterial diversity of the northern pitcher plant here in Wisconsin. So that's a really interesting topic.
Well, first of all, the northern pitcher plant, which we do have throughout the state, especially up north, and then through much of eastern Canada and the U.S., has a hollow leaf which is wide open to rain, insects, and whatever else that can drop in, including bacteria, which can be found on the insects and in the rain and from a variety of other sources. And very little has been done over the years to investigate the role of bacteria in the carnivorous activities of carnivorous plants. And there had been no isolations of different types of microorganisms in pitcher plants, at least until about the 1970s, and therefore it was decreed by my major professor, the late Dr. Elizabeth McCoy, that I go ahead and scratch way below the surface on this for my master's thesis.
So what were your conclusions from this work?
Well, among the various conclusions, I more or less found some expected things and some very unexpected things. Well, of the expected, insect digestion is accompanied by a great increase in the numbers of bacteria. If the plants themselves have digestive enzymes, they're probably not working much, if at all. In fact, I would think bacteria would be probably using them for nutrients if they were present. But among the organisms I've found involved or associated with insect digestion are those that can break down a protein, common organisms like Pseudomonas, the kind of organism that can spoil meat and turn your milk green if you leave it too long in the fridge. And that's been known to happen. And there's also, during insect digestion, a considerable increase in ammonia, which is considered a major plant nutrient and can be taken in through the leaves. And previous studies had shown how amino acids and various minerals could be absorbed through the pitcher leaf. So how bacteria actually, and what bacteria do that sort of thing to insects, kind of expands that somewhat. And the bacteria present in high numbers appeared to have quite an effect on the surface tension of the water, and the insects were more efficiently trapped in the water as a result.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes, that short clip gives our audience at least a kind of a glimpse at some of the different diverse topics that we do at PNM. There's quite a wide range there. And when it comes to morality, getting back to our quiz question, that is, knowing right from wrong, psychologists and neuroscientists alike have their theories as to where people get this. I think that when people hurt other people, they know it's wrong because they feel the other person's pain. So the answer to the quiz question is compassion or empathy, something we all must show in this hour of need. I want to thank everyone in our audience who listened tonight and those who call in. We hope that PNM will continue to be on the air for the next 20 years, even though I probably won't be. So if anyone in our listening audience would like to try their hand in broadcasting science on the radio, please email us at scienceonwart@gmail.com or come to the Wart Studios any Thursday evening around 7 o'clock p.m. We would love to meet you and show you the ropes. This has been another edition of the Equipatrol Notion Machine, brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thanks to all our guests who called in. I guess there weren't really any. Our engineer was Bill Cushman, and I'm your host and producer this evening, Dennis Schaefer. Join us again next week for another exciting edition of the Equipatrol Notion Machine.